Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And that voice you hear in the background is Alan Bradley. He is the author of the new book, A Red Herring Without Mustard. I laugh when I hear that title. And it's the third in the Flavia de Luce series. And he's here to talk about it with us. Hello.
Hello, David.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine. Let me be clear as far as how the character name is pronounced. Can you pronounce it for me?
I sure can. It's Flavia de Luce.
Okay, so I did. I'm pretty close to the... I must say, I absolutely love these books. This is the third book. I'm on the third book now, and I'm just having the time. In fact, I don't want this book to end. I'm so upset that it's going to end.
Thank you very much.
You've really hit upon a really interesting, funny, and unusual mystery series. This is different from anything you'll ever read.
I hope so.
And I just enjoy them so much. And it seems like each one gets better and better. And I mean, she's such an unusual girl. Tell me, I want to hear exactly how you thought her up. I mean, where did she come from?
Okay, she came from the universe. I'm not sure if I told you when we chatted earlier about it, but I had set out to write a golden age English mystery. I was very influenced by people like Dorothy Sayers and Niall Marsh, Agatha Christie, and I had always thought it would be a lot of fun to do an English genteel murder mystery set in the British countryside in around 1950, just at the end of the golden age of England, just after the war. And I had come up with a plot and a detective and a location for it. It was very, very different from the Flavia books. And I started writing it, and I got a couple of chapters into it. And as one of the characters was walking around, traveling through the village, he ran across this 11-year-old girl. And I had not planned her at all. She wasn't part of the story. She wasn't part of the plot. I really came to a standstill when she materialized because I didn't know who she was. I didn't know what her name was. I didn't know anything about her background. And when I finally figured out it's a very long, convoluted story of wandering around in a daze for months trying to guess her name and so forth, but when I finally did and came back to the story, it was apparent right from the first day that Flavia was not going to participate in Alan Bradley's idea of a mystery story. She just was not part of that story and didn't want to have anything to do with my plot or my cast of characters. She really wanted her own story. So I wound up scrubbing the book that I was working on and just retaining the character of this 11-year-old girl who had walked in and hijacked my book. So I started all over again with Flavia. That was The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie was the first book. And it had quite a skyrocket career. It's been absolutely astounding. The first book has been out for 2 years now, and it's still on bestseller lists in Canada and the U.S. and also in Germany, and it's German translation. And in the meantime, I've done the second and third book in the series. The Weed That Strings the Hangman's Bag was the second, and Red Herring Without Mustard, as you mentioned, was the third book. So I realize this is kind of a long roundabout answer to your question, but my vision from the beginning, when I was fairly early in the first book in the series, I knew that it wasn't going to be just one book. There was absolutely no way that I would be able to reveal the richness of Flavia's world that had appeared to me in one book. There was a short while I thought maybe three books, and then it became, as I got farther and farther into the first book, it was absolutely no doubt that I was going to need six books to tell the whole story. So it's been a bit of a ride, because the first book sold in 13 countries.
Wow.
Even before it was written.
That's because it's a good book, that's why. It's a wonderful book.
Well, there are a lot of people who have liked it very much. I've been very favored, I think, in Flavia's fans who have been quite avid supporters of the book, and it's a word-of-mouth thing. A lot of it is word-of-mouth, and people have told. I don't think I've ever met anybody who was a Flavia fan who hadn't told a lot of other people about it, or in some cases even point-blank ordered them to go buy the book.
Where is it selling the best right now? I mean, what country sells the most of it, do you think?
Well, Canada, the U.S. and Canada have been huge, and it's also been a bestseller in Taiwan and also in Holland. But the one that is really kind of surprising, I don't know why it surprises me, but Germany has been right up there with the U.S. The series has been just a huge best-selling. I was in Germany last October, and my goodness, the book was absolutely everywhere you went. You went in a bookstore, and the book was 12 places in the store. It would be under detective fiction. It would be in young adult. It would be in new arrivals. It would be in fiction. It would be in literature. It would be under England category, British travel. Everywhere you look, there were a dozen copies of the book. So my tour of Germany certainly verified that was the case. I've never had a reception anywhere as warm as I did in Germany. It was just indescribable. Germany was the only place I've ever been where booksellers rushed out into the middle of the street and threw their arms around someone who was getting out of a taxi cab.
Is that right?
These were strangers, people that in Hanover that I had never met before, and they were so excited about the book. It was sort of like being a king on holidays.
Well, is it really only going to be six books, or is it possible we'll get more than that? I mean, the thought that it would end after six books is terrifying to me.
Well, I have always viewed the six books as being the long story of Flavia, but I've had a little bit of trouble in people realizing that each book is just one slice of the pie. And they've commented, well, it seemed as if there were some loose ends from each book. And, of course, there are loose ends because the story covers six books. It doesn't just cover one book.
Mm-hmm.
So my initial trajectory of the story was six books. And when we get to that point, there's nothing to preclude there being later books. But we'll see when we get to the end of the six books. I like to say, I suppose if the books hadn't been so wildly successful, I might never have gone on with the series. You know, if they had not been really
now, I should mention,
well received,
right? And they certainly have been. I must admit that these are published, by the way, by Delacorte. The one I have in my hand is. I love the style. I love the fact that they're smaller books. They're not the full hardcover size, and they fit in your hand real nice. There's something about these that just is so wonderful. I mean, this one I have is yellow. The new one is a yellow cover. So each cover is a different color. So they really go on the shelf really well. So who designed the style of the book? I mean, did you know it was going to be a book this size?
No, I didn't. The cover for the first book was done by an artist named Joel Montgomery, who was commissioned to do it for Random House. And I must say that it was a brilliant choice, because I've been told that the conventional wisdom in book publishing is don't ever, ever, ever publish a book with a green cover.
Oh.
And Joe Montgomery broke that rule and came out with an acid green color for the first one. And the second book is an acid purple color, and the third one is either a mustard yellow or an acid yellow, depending on how you look at it.
Do you know what colors the others are going to be?
I am kind of hoping that the next one will be sort of an acid white color, because it's set in the winter. So I don't know how that will interpret at the graphic design level, but I'm kind of hoping that they'll come up. I think they're just beginning to think about it now, because I'm just finishing the fourth book.
I wish I could read it.
Yeah, until the end of next January. January 31st is the publication date. So, it still needs quite a bit of polishing.
You know how much I love these books. I mean, I can hardly wait for the next one. I mean, just the thought of a fourth one is so thrilling to me. I mean, I'm over a half a way through this new one, and I just don't want it to end. I'm so afraid it's going to end. And what am I going to do after that?
I'm glad to hear that. They do get deeper and a bit darker as we go along. The characters.
That's fine with me.
Depth, and they're also gaining background, and also you can begin to. As you get to know them, you can project a little bit into their future as well, so that the whole texture of the thing becomes more dense. Each book in itself is a fairly simple, straightforward story, but there is a long story that runs through the six books, which is very different from each one of the short stories. It's really about Flavia and about her family. Relationship. So when I guess to put it in a nutshell, as I've told people, each one of the books is a mystery on its own, but there is also a long mystery that is threaded through all of the books, and we learn a little more about it in each one. But I wanted to say, just while you were talking about the book design, there's something I've wanted to explain. A number of people have said they were kind of disappointed when the second book came out because it had a dust jacket.
Oh.
All of the books have had dust jackets in Canada, but in the U.S. they were this very slightly smaller than normal. A number of people have said they reminded them a lot of the Nancy Drew book.
Oh, yeah.
The cover art being printed right directly on the hard cover. And they did that for the first book. It had no dust jacket. But there were a number of complaints from some of the big book retailers who said, when we put a sticker on the front of the book, like something saying bestseller or 20% off or whatever, when they peeled the sticker off, that the cover tended to come with it.
Oh.
And it did some physical damage to the book, and for that reason, the second book, they decided that it would be better to go with a dust jacket so that stickers could be peeled off more easily. But with the third book, as you've seen, they've gone back to the hardcover again, so I would imagine that they had a lot of feedback from readers. And it now looks as if the hardcover is going to be the standard for the series.
Now, Flavia doesn't get along with her two sisters, and there's a constant sense that, you know, they just don't get along, and maybe they never will. And, you know, just reading the book, you think, I wonder if they really love each other. You know, what's going on with that? And even the relationship between Flavia and her father is kind of strained too. But are we going to find out more about the Colonel, do you think Flavia will get along better with her sisters later on, or is that going to be a recurring theme?
Well, I think her relationship with them is pretty established, but at this point in the series, Flavia really doesn't know why any of these things. She doesn't know why her father is the way he is. She just observes that he's very reclusive and uncommunicative with her, doesn't really seem to be terribly interested in things.
He's really kind of a religious fanatic, too.
Yes, as far as his stamp collection goes, he is a religious fanatic. But because Flavia is only 11, she knows the superficial facts of things, but she doesn't know the why behind a lot of things about her family, about her mother, about her father, about her sisters. And as we go along, she finds out more and more and more about them, and we won't know all of that until we get to the end of the sixth book.
That's kind of thrilling. That's really thrilling to know that. To know that there's things coming up. So by the end of the sixth book, are we going to know everything? Are we going to know why she doesn't get along with her father? Why she doesn't get along with her sisters? Are we going to know everything like that? I mean, is there going to be more stuff revealed about?
You'll know as much about it as she knows about it, as she discovers things. She's still at the end of the sixth book. She's still 11. Because each one of the books is set only a couple of months apart. So we started with the first book in June of 1950, and each one has been at an interval of very, very approximately 2 months. So at the end of the sixth book, we will be roughly in June of 1951, and Flavia is still... In the first book, she's almost 11, and at the end of the series, she'll be almost 12.
Well, one of the things that thrills me about this is the fact that you had the first six named already. I thought I went onto your website and they're the first six. So you know, do you know what 4, 5, and 6 are already going to be about? Do you know the whole plot of each book?
No, I wouldn't say I know the entire plot. I know what the topic and the setting is for each book, and how it connects with the story of the family and so forth. But as far as minute-by-minute plotting or who some of the minor characters might be, no, I don't know that until I actually get into the book.
Well, that's it. That's good. That's probably better for us that you don't... Not that we can reveal anything that's coming up anyway, because, I mean, but...
The way I work is that with the characters being so well established, it's just a matter of putting them on the page and then sit back and watch them interact. I can't force them to do things that I think would be interesting or things that I think would be clever or funnier, and it just doesn't work for me. I have to strictly maintain a hands-off attitude and listen to the characters and let them interact with one another without using me as a mouthpiece to mediate between them. And it seems to work fairly well. It's, I guess, really a matter of learning to shut up and listen to your characters.
Now, is the plan to keep one? Is it to keep it a one a year, or is it possible you'll write two in 1 year?
No, it's one a year is a pretty grueling schedule to keep up with for writing, especially with the series taking off. I'm doing a lot of traveling, and I just got back from a tour of Norway, and I'm going to the UK in a couple of days.
Well, when is that? When is the United States going to have you here?
Well, I was there last year. I did a,
oh, you were.
A major, you know, one of those 12 cities in 5 weeks, where I was spending a day flying and a day talking and a day flying and a day talking. So I thought maybe I kind of wore out my welcome in the U.S. I was everywhere, and Canada too. So we kind of decided that we wouldn't do it again for this book, simply because it would be just a little too grueling.
Right. Plus, we want you working on those other three.
Yeah, I've got a full-time job writing the other three, and then traveling and talking to people about the books.
Now, you were
a tour of Malta.
Right. Now, you were born in Toronto.
Last week. Yes.
Now, I wonder why, I mean, what? How old were you when you first started writing? I mean, you've done this later in life. Is that true? That's the kind of, what I kind of indicates that on your website, that you didn't, you were doing other things earlier in your life, and now you're, writing seems to be what you really love. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. I started writing my first book when I was five, and
five?
My sisters scoffed at it so much. Yeah, my first novel. They fell on the floor laughing at my opening paragraph, so it took me about over 60 years to get back to it again.
Wow. But, I mean, you're such an interesting writer. I mean, these books are, I mean, just, I was reading Red Herring Without Mustard last night, and there's just parts of the book that are just so enjoyable, and you're like, oh, I can't wait to see how this plays out. You know, the thing with the mirror, the mirror scene where she writes the thing on the mirror is just amazing. It's like, now what's going to happen as a result of that? I mean, is Flavia going to get killed? I mean, is somebody going to kill her? And why is she so obsessed with poisons? Where did that idea come from to do that? It's such a wonderful idea. I mean, it works so well with the books. But I'm almost afraid Flavia's going to kill somebody.
Well, I think she sometimes has very good intentions, but she's always being waylaid by having to solve a crime or rescue somebody or do something that's much more noble than poisoning. So she can be a little bit frustrated, but poisoning, I thought, was interesting because it's always talked about in literature as being the woman's crime, that it's peculiarly a crime that is practiced by women. I don't know if that's true, but at least that's what they say. And it really came with her. Stretching it too much when I tell people that when Flavia materialized, she came pretty well complete with all of her attributes, her family, her house, her chemistry lab, this wasn't something that I sat down and laboriously plotted on a piece of paper or anything. It just came as a package with Flavia. The thing that interests me the most, I spend a lot of time talking about it with people, is that I've always been really intrigued with that 11-year-old intensity of focus, that some 11-year-old kids can be frighteningly intense and narrow in many ways. So Flavia is like that. She knows everything that there is to know about chemistry, but nothing about sex. She doesn't know anything about her own family. So there's that great stress between the huge, voluminous amount of information that she knows about chemistry and on the other side of this vast, deep gulf is real life. She's quite removed from it and actually not very interested in it, so all of her enthusiasms, things that she goes on about are largely things that she's heard secondhand from her sisters. Her view of world literature, of books, of reading, of human relationships, things that go on in the village, scandal, gossip, weirdness, are all things that she's heard from other people. So it's all filtered through someone else, and it's kind of interesting that she has these great blank places in her pool of knowledge.
Now you were born in Toronto, but how did you end up in Malta? That's quite a distance from Toronto. How did that come about? Was it just your work, or did you just love Malta?
Yeah, well, I worked in the television broadcasting business, radio and TV broadcasting, for all of my working career, and it took me across Canada. I started in Ontario and wound up retiring in British Columbia, so we were out on the West Coast, and we were pretty well settled there. I guess we were retired, and we had built a new house, and we thought we would be there forever. But my wife and I had both had jobs that we never really had much opportunity to travel. So when the books came along, and they're now sold in 34 countries.
Wow.
Most of my publishers are in Europe.
And you've won a lot of awards, too.
Yeah, they have. Someone pointed out the other day in the Canadian edition of Red Herring Without Mustard, they put a page in the front of it that says that it's the most award-winning mystery ever, which kind of surprised me. I know that it's won a lot of awards, but I didn't realize that it had set a record for winning them. So, yeah, I have some just wonderful awards around me here, the Agatha Award and the Barry Award. And
you have them all there in that room with you?
Yeah, I do. I'm
oh,
looking
wonderful.
At them as we speak.
Wow. I want to see. I wish you guys.
I was going to say the Arthur Ellis Award from Canada.
Time
Writers of Canada. And the Dillis Award. My goodness, I'm surrounded with all these gorgeous awards.
And you're very humble about it, too. I mean, you're not, I mean, I can tell you're just a very humble man. Just from talking to you, I can see that you're not, you know, right, it's very easy as a writer when you become successful and to really have an ego and to really be difficult. But you're very down to earth. You're a very normal guy.
Well, thank you. As I said, I spent about 35 years in television broadcasting, and a lot of that in studios in contact with, quotation marks, famous people, end of quotation marks. And I think there were times 30, 40 years ago where you would occasionally think, my God, if I'm ever like that, shoot me.
Right.
So I'm not wildly impressed with people who put themselves on a pedestal when they manage to sell some books.
I just had a really wild thought. You know the girl that was in Atonement, and she was also in that Lovely Bones. I think she'd make a perfect Flavia.
Right. Yes.
I don't know her name. She's got a very unusual name, but I can picture her face, and I think she would be good. Do you know what?
There's been a huge amount of film interest in the Flavia series, but so far I'm resisting.
Oh, really? And why is that?
Well, I think I would be very uncomfortable to think of other people working with my character while I was asleep. I would have a hard time handing her over to somebody else. I wouldn't want to think that people are sitting at a computer somewhere creating Flavia's life. I am much more responsible to her than just to hand her over for something like money. It's too important to me. So we'll see when the series is finished.
That's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. I mean, and even resistant as far as a TV show, as on the BBC or something.
Yeah. There's been a lot of interest both in movies and
on TV.
TV, but yeah, I was telling somebody recently. It reminded me. Do you remember years ago the Reader's Digest used to have some kind of a column called I Learned About Life from That.
Okay.
There was some little incident about things that taught you a lesson, and it reminded me of many years ago, I think it was probably in the mid-70s, and I was publishing children's short stories occasionally in a book called The Canadian Children's Annual, and did a lot of readings in schools and talking to school kids. And I can remember reading a short story I had written. It was sort of a takeoff on a fairy tale in which a little character was rambling through the countryside, and a storm blew up, and a lightning bolt struck a tree, and it glanced off and killed a cow that was in a field.
Mm.
And I thought it was quite humorous. It was written as a very lighthearted scene, and I read it in a school one day in Saskatoon in Canada, and a little girl got up and she said, "You just put put that part in about the cow to be funny, didn't you? And I was quite taken aback, and I said, well, you're right, I did put the cow in just for the sake of a joke. And she said, you can't do that. You, when you create, God would never allow that to happen. She said, when you create a character, you have to be responsible for it.
Mm.
Or a character or an animal. And I've never... never had that out of my mind, that I'm responsible for the characters in the book, and I can't allow other people to do the wrong thing with them.
Absolutely, I agree, and I totally understand. And I mean, they do so much with movie characters nowadays. You never know what, from the book to the movie, they change so much. You know, and it's kind of scary when a book that you love can be so turned around by a movie and dictated by, you know, what they can afford to show on a movie screen rather than what it really is
right.
In the book. And I don't
know. Yes, there have been a number of cases of mystery series that writers had a huge amount of grief in selling them, that there were things done with the characters that were just absolutely appalling. I think P.D. James, for example, was so upset by what they did with one of her characters that she said she would never write that character again. And I can understand that.
Now, the gypsy that gets... somebody tries to kill the gypsy in the beginning of this book, and the gypsy's an interesting character, but it's very... I love the fact you have a gypsy, and she's telling Flavie all these weird things about her life. I mean, there's so many interesting things about the book. You never quite know where the book's going. You never. I mean, all of a sudden she'll start something on a new line of something, and it'll be, oh wow, now what's she gonna? She's gonna get in trouble, and she always ends up getting in trouble. It's just a question of, is she going to be able to get out of this trouble that she's in? But it's so much fun to watch her.
Yeah, well, digressions are always fun. I know there are readers who don't like digressions. They want a book to start with a murder on page one and have the person solving it pretty well have it figured out by 50 pages in, and the rest of it is all sort of blood and guts. But one of the interesting things about the Flavia stories is that 11-year-olds really have magpie minds. They're learning and growing and expanding their minds, and they're always taking in new things and have these wonderful enthusiasm. Somebody tells them about something that they've never ever heard of before, and it just overwhelms them, just the whole idea that this could be the case. And so they do digress a bit, but I think there's a certain kind of mind that enjoys these books. I think people that love knowledge tend to really like them. I've never met, personally, I've met a lot of Flavia fans at book signings, and they're all people who would be friends, you know, even if I weren't writing the books and they weren't readers, we would still be friends. We always hit it off. So I'm not sure if there's a character type that enjoys them, or people who at least are entertained by the same kinds of things that I am. But it's a wonderful unity to go out and meet people that you can, within 5 seconds, you know, you feel as if you've known them forever.
Now, I want to read the opening line of the book. It's funny. The first thing the gypsy says is, "You frighten me. Never have I seen my crystal ball so filled with darkness." I mean, what a great opening line. I mean, right away you think, well, why is she saying that? I have to know what's going to... So you, right away you drag the reader into this story, and it's just fascinating. And, you know, what's she going to say? And is it really going to come true? And what's going to happen to Flavia? Is Flavia going to have a terrible life ahead of her?
Right. Right. Well, again, I refer you to Book 6 when it comes, and a lot of these things will become clear. I was talking to somebody recently, and they said, "What do you hope for the series?" And I said, "Well, my fondest hope is that when they finish Book 6, when they turn the last page of Book 6, they're going to say, 'Oh, my God,' and go back to Book 1 again and read it all over again." from the beginning and say, well, my goodness, it was all there and we didn't see it.
There's all kinds of different things happening with mysteries nowadays. I know that, and you've probably heard of Louise Penny, who just recently...
Yes, Louise is actually the godmother of the Flavia series.
Is that right?
I've never actually met her, but I've had a lot of correspondence with her. And Louise was being interviewed about three, four years ago on CBC Radio in Canada. And my wife, who never listens to the radio, she's a quilter, for some reason took a radio into her quilting room and turned it on, and just in time to hear Louise being interviewed. And Louise was explaining how she had got her start in detective writing by winning or being shortlisted for the Debut Dagger Award in the UK. And she gave a bit of background on how to do this yourself if you were interested. And my wife wrote it all down on a piece of paper and came into where I was writing, and she said, you have to, I've just heard Louise Penny on the radio, you have to take what you've written and send it to the Debut Dagger in London. So I did, and it won the Debut Dagger.
Isn't that
amazing? And so I was absolutely thrilled. I think Louise was the first person that I told when I found out it had won the Dagger. I emailed her, and I had read her first one or two books before and admired her greatly. She's just absolutely wonderful on setting and character.
And she's got, and the last two books have been connected, which is really interesting. So you have a mystery that plays itself over two books instead of one, which is very unusual. I love that idea of doing something different like that.
Yeah, that was a great idea. I think she and I started the sort of multiple book storyline at about the same time without being aware that either one was doing that, because I don't discuss her books or her plots with her, and she doesn't discuss my plots with me.
But she has read your books.
She certainly, yes, she has. In fact, she's. I think she provided a very, very nice commendation for Red Herring, at least in the Canadian edition. A very, very generous assessment, which is printed on the dust jacket.
Do you see yourself as very gifted, do you see just a lifetime of learning that has finally come to, or what? How exactly do you see your ability to write? Obviously, you have a great ability to write and a great ability with characters, and how do you see that?
Yeah, well, bless you. I mentioned a while ago having 11-year-olds having a magpie mind, and I think I've somehow been able to maintain mine since I've been 11, that I have that very acquisitive thing that I just bounce from one to another. I love finding out about something new that I didn't know before, and usually something that's kind of offbeat. So every book I read will usually send me scurrying to look up other books, and you go from chemistry to geology to folklore and whatnot, and each book sends you to a bunch of other books, and I just love new knowledge about things that were a total blank to me before. So I probably, as long as I'm able to read, I will be like that. I don't settle into one channel.
Now, you say you're working on book four. You're almost done book four, you said?
It's getting towards the end. Yeah, I have a deadline of the end of June to deliver the manuscript, so it's well along.
So when will you start book five then, after that?
Probably fairly soon now, as I get into polishing book four. There are times when I leave it alone for a while, just to get a bit of perspective on it, so I can walk away from it for a week or two, and then I use that time to research the next book and come up with some of the background ideas and so forth.
Now, the last book being titled Nasty Light of Day, is that sort of imply that we're going to find out all these things that we've been wondering about for five books?
Yes. Pretty well. I don't know if that will stay the title. Some of the titles when I projected the six-book series were just sort of place markers that I needed to have a title for them so that they could be discussed with other people. But the fourth book, which I think was originally called Death in Camera, the proper title was just announced recently by Random House, book four. It's going to be called I Am Half Sick of Shadows.
Right, what a great title.
Yeah, that's from Tennyson, of course. It's from The Lady of Shalott.
Oh, I see. Are all the titles...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, are all the titles from different authors, from other authors? I mean, are they quotes from other authors, or...?
They have been so far, but that's only a coincidence. I haven't intentionally made them quotes from other authors. They've been phrases that have come up that just grabbed me. The first one, The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie, I had the title long before the book was written. Even before I knew what the book was about, I had come across that little quotation from The Art of Cookery by King, unless some sweetness at the bottom lie, who cares for all the crinkling of the pie? And where that came from was I'm just an absolute pushover for old reference books. I love ancient reference books. I have on my shelf Whitaker's Almanac for 1950 and Law's Grocer's Manual from 1947 and Bradshaw's April 1910 Railway Guide. And,
wow.
Hazel's Annual for 1908. So if 1908 ever comes back again, I've got it made. I was at a garage sale about 20 years ago, and there was somebody had a set of the Modern Eclectic Dictionary of the English Language in six volumes, beautifully bound in linen and stamped with gold leaf. And I bought them for $17. And I don't think there's been any reference book that I've used more, because it's sort of an encyclopedia. It not only defines the words, but it gives examples and actually has a lot of chemistry experiments in it, too.
Wow.
And I was just browsing through it one day, and I ran across the word crinkle. And I thought, gee, that's nice. You know, nobody says crinkle anymore.
No.
I haven't heard anybody say crinkle for years. And it's such a lovely word. And they gave an example of each word, had a little example of how it was to be used in English. And the example was, unless some sweetness at the bottom lie, who cares for all the crinkling of the pie? And it just jumped off the page at me, and I thought, that's it. The sweetness at the bottom of the pie. That's a book that...
That's definitely wonderful. I mean, I just hear you talk about it. It's exciting. I mean, it really is interesting. So, are there audio versions?
We have a pie.
Right.
We had to have a pie in the book.
Right. Now, are there audio versions of your books and e-books and everything? Have they done all those so far?
Yes, they have. In fact, there are many. In the U.S., there are the Random House audio books, which are read by Jane Entwistle. They're also published by Random House. There are several in the UK. There is an abridged version. There is a totally different unabridged version. And there is a third version in England, which they produce for export trade, which is not sold in England, but is sold in Australia and New Zealand. So there are... at this point, there are about four different versions of each one of the books in audiobook.
Is there anything that people coming into the series without any knowledge of what they're going to be about, is there something that people need to know? Are there any phrases that people should know about, things that they might not understand with these books?
Well, they do have English terminology in them. There's nothing probably that wouldn't be solved by a quick look at the dictionary. I think most of the terminology in them is evident within the story, that it shouldn't stop you cold reading, that you basically can get an idea of what's going on in the sentence without having to go and look. But I have heard from a number of people that said, gee, what a joy it was to be sent off to the dictionary and find all this background information that you've used but not expressly put in the book.
Right. There were a couple of terms. There were a couple of terms I had to look up on, and I got my dictionary out online and just looked them up, but I don't remember the terms now, but there were a couple that I wasn't sure what they meant, so you do have to look
up.
Yeah,
the language has changed a lot in the last 60 years. It really has. People don't use the same, well, crinkle, for example,
right,
is a word that might have almost fallen out of use in present times. I don't know if you said crinkle to an 11-year-old now, if they would understand what you meant.
Right. Aren't there like crinkle French fries, crinkly French fries? I think there are. I think that's...
Yes, there are.
You don't hear it all that often. Now, what are you going to do after the sixth book is published? I mean, do you have your vision down the line that far? You're not going to stop writing, are you?
Oh, goodness, no. No. There have been so many ideas kicked around. There's an enormous, huge wave of enthusiasm about it, and I really have to stay focused. I can't get off sort of freewheeling these ideas because it's too distracting. They're very exciting, but some of the publishers have talked about things like, you know, Flavia's History of Poisons or Flavia's Notebook or some little materials that go along with the novels without actually being a novel. There have been discussions about a volume of short stories.
Oh, wow. So there's all kinds of ideas.
So, there's no shortage of ideas. It's a matter of me keeping my nose to the grindstone and getting in the proper number of hours writing.
Isn't it great to have the right, to have created this character and have the rights to them and nobody else can do anything with it? I mean, it must be a great feeling to know you have something this good.
Yeah, you're right, absolutely right about that. I love it because working in the television business, you spend your whole life realizing other people's ideas, never your own.
Now you have your own.
Yeah, and television is so transient. You do something and it's transmitted and then it's gone off into the ether somewhere, and aside from DVD or something, nobody's ever going to see it again, where the books are much more permanent. You know, people are going to be reading them for a few years anyway. So it's nice to be self-employed and have these characters to spend my day with.
Right. Now, I must ask you about the spider on the outside of the book. Now, am I supposed to know why there's a spider on this? I assume this is the crystal ball from the gypsy on the cover. Why is the spider there? Should I know why it is, or am I dumb, or what?
No, I have no idea. I know that people have asked about covers. With the first book, somebody said, well, that bird isn't a snipe. And they actually questioned Joe Montgomery on the Internet at one point, and he said, well, if you understand the position of a book designer, the thing is to attract attention to the book. And the interpretation is very seldom a literal one for a book jacket. But if you're looking for literal illustration, you're not going to find it. And that, of course, is true of most books. It's meant to be an attractive cover. And I think it works well. I've had a number of people tell me, you know, I can actually spot one of your books from across the store.
Wow.
And I think that's the greatest tribute that a book designer could ever have.
It must have been thrilling for you when you first walked into a store to see one of your books. I mean, what was that like for you?
Yeah, it was sort of like standing with one foot in each foot in a different world. I don't know, the first pile of books that I saw was in one of the big chain retailers in the city that I was living in at the time, and I walked in and they had a table full of them. And of course, you know, you've been going there a couple of times a week for years, and you see piles of books by people like Elizabeth George and Dan Brown and so forth, and you walk in one day and there's the sweetness at the bottom of the pie in the same position and the same quantities. And it's a little bit unworldly. I don't know if you ever connect with it entirely.
And you've made the New York Times best-selling list for Red Herring Without Mustard. Now, I don't know if the first two made the list. I looked over
there. Yeah, they did. Actually, the first two were on for a while. The second book was on the extended list. But the really interesting thing that we see happening is now that the third book is out, there are many, many people are going back and picking up the first two books, which they hadn't read before, and so the first two have had quite a wild resurgence of sales, and I think it was about 3 weeks ago, all three of the books were on the New York Times bestseller list.
Is that right?
All at the same time, yeah. One was number 9, one was number 25, and one was number 31, or some such thing, but I know that everybody was wildly excited that there were three books on the list.
Wow, and, that is exciting.
Red Herring was number 1 on the Canadian bestseller list at the same time, so it...
So everything's going so well for you right now. I mean,
it is.
And it's got to be a great feeling. Do you read a lot too, also? I mean, do you read other mystery writers? Do you read? Do you keep up with current fiction, and what kind of?
No, I don't try to. I find that it's distracting when I'm writing. When I'm actually in a writing phase where I'm working 12, 14 hours a day, that I have to keep my head in 1950 in Bishop's Lacey. It's a mistake to be pulled out of it by somebody else's world. And I tend not to read fiction, or if I do, I read fiction that is very, very different from mystery fiction. While I was working on Red Herring, I read The Sea by John Banville.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've read that.
It's a popular book at our store.
Far removed. Yeah, and I loved it. I thought it was absolutely a wonderful, wonderful creation of a world. I love, as I say, old reference books. I can browse through them endlessly, just looking for things that leap out at me. And I like sort of offbeat books. I found a tremendous book that I'm reading right now, which is called Elephant's Breath and London Smoke.
Hmm.
And it's lists of historical colors. The lady who wrote it has gone back through a couple of hundred years of books and magazines and found every reference that she could to shades of color, which are now long gone, things that nobody's ever heard of before. And she's tracked them down, where the name of the color came from and what it looked like and so forth. And you would think this would be a 64-page pamphlet, but it's about a 300-page book where she just lists and comments on historical colors like elephant's breath.
Hmm.
And I love that kind of thing. It just creates so many images in your mind. You can read through these lists and look at the years when this color, this shade was popular in 1795, and wonderful creation. So I like that that kind of abstract, factual sort of thing for relaxing reading.
Right. Oh, that's great. You know, I want to get back to the book. I have to go to work, but I want to sit down and read the rest of this book. I'm so You got me torn now.
Okay.
You're really killing me with these things now.
Well, we can always do a part two, interview part two.
That's absolutely true. You know, it's been absolutely delightful to talk to you. You're a fascinating man and an unbelievably good writer. I mean, and I really look forward to book 4, 5, and 6. I can't wait to read them.
Good. Well, thank you. We're 2/3 of the way through the series already. It's hard to believe.
It is, but you're just having the time of your life, and we're having the time of our life reading them. So everybody wins, and it's just wonderful. And you can go out now and get this Red Herring Without Mustard in all your bookstores. It's out from Delacour Press, and Alan's been talking to us for the whole hour, and it's been an absolute delight. And I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, David. It's really been a lot of fun.
Yeah, me too. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.